Hello, everybody. I continue to be John Atack, and I'm delighted to welcome Anthony Spurgeon. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, everybody. It's great to be back.
And your story is basically your parents got involved with traditional Catholicism, where you have the Tridentine Mass, the Mass in Latin and this kind of stuff. And there are a bunch of groups now that splintered away from the Roman Catholic Church into this form. And while you were involved, and people can watch the first show we did together to see this, you were subjected to abusive treatment, let's say. And you've spoken out about that, and you're now concerned to help many other people who are living in similar circumstances. So let's go from there. What's new?
Awesome. Well, what's new is that since thank you, first of all, thank you once again, John, for having me on, and hello to John's audience. What's changed since then is I've started a new channel entitled "The Dragons of a Victory." Interesting title, and let
it
me
is an interesting
explain
title.
it for.
Yeah, please do.
So here's where it comes from. The idea behind that title for this channel was I didn't want my name attached to this particular channel. I want to make more content on the internet, and I want to have my name on it, but I want that stuff to be more artistic, more perhaps less controversial, perhaps less this work of talking about my experience, in some ways I consider a side project, because I don't want this mission to consume my life, because it's a toxic rabbit hole at the end of the day. But at the same time, I want this to get out there, and I want people to be more aware, and I also want my experience to have meant something, and to have some, and in the end of the day, for it to been to bring some, to not have been for naught, to be able to bring about some positive change in response to it. So, but I didn't want my name on this channel. I wanted there to be almost like a banner or a theme. So the dragon part came from the fact that traditional Catholics actually sort of believe dragons are real. And let me explain how. So they definitely have a story of a Saint George and the dragon, and a medieval knight who slew a dragon. And I feel like definitely across the board now, if you were in a modern Catholic school or a mainstream Catholic school, the teacher, the priest, whatever, would not tell you that Saint George literally fought a dragon. He would find a way to bring some sort of, like they do with the first chapters of Genesis, he would bring in this metaphorical understanding of that text that really wasn't a thing for the church in a very long time. It was very, very literal. But anyway, they definitely think that hardcore traditional Catholics are creationists. So they think that humans were the Adam and Eve are riding around on Triceratops. So oftentimes they'll say, well, when they saw dragons in the ancient legends, it was just dinosaurs. That's all they were talking about. And so that whole idea of dragons being real, and that whole attitude they have, and they don't like it also. It's a weird thing. Oftentimes say it's bad to portray dragons as good in literature and movies. You've got to always portray them as evil. So if you're ever watching something with a good dragon, don't let your kids, if your kids are watching something with a good dragon, don't let them watch it. Again, that's sort of a, even among traditional Catholics, that's not necessarily a widespread idea, but when you get more into the weeds, you hear stuff like that. And so the of victory part comes from, they have Our Lady of Victory, an apparition of Mary. They talk about, they say things like, we've already won the war. Like, God is already victorious. Or if we stay the course, it's not like, you know, this spiritual battle we're in, it's not like we have any chance of losing. So, because we're going to go to heaven eventually, and God's already victorious. So all that's required of us is to stay the course. Victory is already ours. So It's sort of like reclaiming the idea of dragons and reclaiming the idea of victory and in my own way. And I want the channel to be not just me talking, but I want it to also be a repository for my interviews and anyone who ha and I want it also at some point to be a channel where other people can upload their own content or their own stories without having to go through creating their own channels or whatever. They can just send it to me. So I'm sure John, you'll, when this goes up, you'll have the link to our channel. And so yeah,
Absolutely.
just check us out. We're the Dragons of Victory. If you're at all curious about this whole issue of traditional Catholicism, yeah, come out and reach out to us. And real quick, I also want to mention another organization, Trad Recovery, a support group that has been set up. The woman who runs that, Laura Vandervoss, is still a Catholic, but she was also raised in a traditional Catholic culture like I was. And I think her story and her group is a good it really shows a point I've been making this whole time, which is the Grand Canyon of difference between the traditional Catholics and the modern normal Catholics today. They're practically two different religions. And this Trad Recovery group is a good resource for people who see, like me, there was a time I tried to stay Catholic after I left traditional Catholics, but it was like sand running out of a sieve. I just couldn't retain, I just couldn't hold on to it anymore. But I really wanted to. And there's a part of me that definitely still misses that comfort and that sense of security. And so for people who still don't, who don't want to lose their Catholic faith, I think you can have a perfectly healthy experience for the most part. It depends on still, but it's very possible to have a good, healthy experience as a mainstream Catholic. And so go to them if that's your concern, and you can come to me or Kevin Nontradicath or others if you've already lost, if that's a lost cause for you.
I mean, to pick up on some of the points you've made, the first is that you want to retain your own persona as Anthony and be the creative person and keep this work separate. But you feel compelled to do something to expose the experience that is being had by people within traditionalist sects. It's important to say that there are a variety of traditionalist sects, and the objection to those sects, or indeed to any sect, is: are they authoritarian? Are they bullying people? Are they forcing people to do things? Are they undemocratic in their approach? And do they lack compassion? And so the thing I remember from our last conversation is that if you had impure thoughts, you were forced to kneel on your own hands to cause yourself pain to make you think about this. Now, I think that any group that practices sadism of this kind is reprehensible, especially when you're dealing, I mean, you were a teenager, right? So this was a time when you probably had quite a lot of impure thoughts. And so you're put
Yeah,
into
I was
this
going through puberty.
situation. So your morality is being dictated to you, and that's a terrible, bad thing. In terms of the people coming out and wanting to continue with the beliefs, but with the essential and good beliefs rather than with the abusive and authoritarian beliefs. Of course, the Catholic Church has weathered many storms, particularly in the last decades, with the terrible child abuse scandals, and hopefully has emerged from this a better organization, a more caring organization. I've had my friend Callan Slipper on the channel. Callan, I've known Callan since we were 2 years old. And he's basically an ecumenical advisor to the Archbishop of Canterbury. And so his concern is to keep the Christian churches functioning in an ethical and proper fashion, and to maintain discourse between them. So there is he's a very good man, and so there is this powerful effort to cleanse the past. Dragons. Well, of course, George, Saint George, is the patron saint of England. He's also the patron saint of Ukraine. So I'm horrified to hear you suggest that he didn't actually slay a dragon. I mean, grief, you know. The next thing you'll be suggesting that the monarchy's authoritarian in some way, then difficult.
Maybe
So,
not so much anymore, but it certainly was.
yeah,
I mean,
I worry about it to this day, frankly. But and I can't see King Charles going out, and he might slay a few King Charles spaniels, but I can't really see him. I think a dragon would be too much, and
no, not even a Komodo dragon.
yeah, well, I must say Komodo dragons were in my mind. They are pretty vicious things, and
Yeah,
taking
they're the
one of those on,
closest thing
yeah,
to real dragon.
they are, and the idea of that dinosaurs, triceratops, were roaming the earth at the same time, because of course Bishop Usher worked out that the creation happened in the year 4004 BC by adding up the ages of all of the patriarchs of Israel, and the dinosaurs disappeared, oh, quite a long time ago, tens of millions of years ago, before they would have had a chance to ride them. Bill Hicks, of course, is very good on was very good on this subject, and the piece he called did called Revelations. He talks about dinosaurs and Jesus and how to try and get those ideas. He gets the wrong date though for Bishop Usher, so it was 6,000 years ago. Let's just correct that fault in Bill Hicks'
Yeah, do
work.
your homework, Bill.
Yeah, a bit late now.
Marc Maron has a great bit on his visit to the Creation Museum in Kentucky. You can listen to that. He just goes through the whole museum, seeing all the seeing like the displays of the paper mache, or whatever figures of Adam and Eve, and there's a Diplodocus, and he's like giving it a pineapple and stuff like that. And then it just and that yeah, they built whole museums to this. There's a lot of there's on the one hand, it's easy to laugh, on the other hand, but at the same time, it's important to understand that, especially in this country, there is widespread acceptance of these ideas, and there's large institute, and I mean, we all know this on the level, but it's something that it kind of ruins the party atmosphere in terms of making light or laughing at these things, when you understand the gravity of the fact that these ideas hold, and it becomes a lot more serious, and that's been an important thing for me too in all of this, and why I've been so careful, and why I haven't really I'm not dedicating my all to this, is because I'm afraid of doing something that I guess will, turn people off, or give people the wrong impression of my intentions. It's happened already, but it's the internet. There's nothing you can do. But I never wanted to be sort of the angry atheist, the amazing, that guy at the channel, The Amazing Atheist, who atheist influencers who are professional mockers of faith and belief. And there's a place for that. But I think the place for that is when people are taking these beliefs and taking direct action with them against another person. That's when you can mock them. And you can mock them specifically at the person. So if someone has these same beliefs, but they're not acting on them in any destructive way, I don't think you have the right to belittle them. But I think you do have the right to belittle them if they are either advocating for an authoritarian implementation of their ideas, or they act out violently or aggressively in any way. And there's cleaning trucks outside, garbage trucks. Hope they're not too loud.
No, I can't hear them. Yeah,
Okay, yeah, but
I
yeah.
think that we have the right to belittle. It's not the word I'd normally use, but I think we have the right to make fun of anything. I
We
think
have the
in
right to, yeah.
our current political atmosphere that we have gone way too far in trying to be nice about idiotic beliefs. And, you know, a pineapple, you know, if it had been a mango, I could have believed it, you know. But so, and while I tend towards your point of view, the problem is that if people sincerely believe absurdities, no matter how nice they are, you end up with something like, and every internet conversation goes there, you end up with the Nazis. You end up with a group of people, very nice, lovely German people, who have come to believe absurdities. And as Ramachandran, the second premier of India, said, people who believe absurdities may commit atrocities. And so when you
Not
get enough
there.
of this going on, so it's difficult that there's a period in English history in the 1720s when King George had come over from Hanover and he didn't want to be here. He didn't like it here. The weather was rubbish and he wanted to go back to Hanover. So he created the first prime minister. And what happened was that the censorship laws, which were meant to be renewed, which were very strict, lapsed. And suddenly the great period of British satire began. So you've got Gilray, for example, Hogarth, a whole bunch of really savage cartoonists. So I think that I'd add something to your formulation, which is that public figures have put themselves out there. Now, I understand what you say about turning people off, you know, that you don't want to push somebody away. So if you're trying to get somebody out of Scientology, then you're not going to say, well, Ron Hubbard was a lunatic, a sadist. Scientology is nonsense and it doesn't work. They've already stopped listening to you. So if one's objective is to persuade people, then it's sensible to do that in bite-sized portions. But
yeah.
I think we have to be careful because the other end of that is a cancel culture where we don't talk about things anymore because you're not meant to. And I think that the way that that damps down free speech. So let me give you a specific example. Spitting Image in the UK in the 70s, in the 80s, very important force and probably had too much impact on our politicians by attacking particularly the Liberal Democrat politicians who, you know, should have had better results at the polls than they did. And it may have had something to do with it. But they did a show called Ron and Nancy in the United States. And I thought, oh, this is great. It's time that this was done. And what we got in the UK, one episode had Ronald Reagan as president. And somebody says to him, the future of the world rests on your shoulders, Mr. President. And Ronald Reagan goes, I thought that was just dust. Oh, I see what you mean. So this was fairly hard satire. In fact, it was satire against a man who at that time was suffering from dementia and who was the most powerful man in the world. So when Ron and Nancy went to the US, we got what the difference was between the British, fairly harsh sense of satire, and the American. And it was anodyne, it was bland, it was tedious, and it was boring. And so I think being able to roll with the punches, being able to take a little criticism without becoming ferocious or you know, protective, we have to be difficult.
Yeah.
Pineapple, I'm sorry. If it had been a mango, you know, no problem. Maybe
yeah.
Stephen
Well,
Mango,
actually,
we've wandered in Scientology territory all of a sudden, but no.
It all comes full circle,
I don't think you
right?
should feed Stephen Mango to anybody else. I'm not saying that. Especially not a Diplodocus.
Not a Diplodocus, or anything. No, I wanted, you made a good point there because I think that you guys are far more better at satire than we are. In fact, I know
We don't get
my
offended
parents were
quite
a
as
big
easily. Yeah.
Well, my parents were a big show fan of the show Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister,
So was Margaret
which
Thatcher. She watched it every week.
Yeah, no, it's hilarious. It's a hilarious show. It's really good, especially if you know about, you know, British politics. And I know that Jonathan Lynn was asked, you know, why not, you know, make this why not make Yes, Mr. President? Why not, you know, translate this to America?
It'd be the
And he
West
said,
Wing.
what was that?
It would be the West Wing and very
It would
serious.
be the West Wing, yeah, except that was a drama, you know. But
That's what I'm saying. It wouldn't be a comedy anymore, you know.
who wouldn't be? Yeah, Jonathan Lynn's answer was American comedy. It's comfortable. It more it, it's like it, there's the sit it was the time of sitcoms and stuff, and you know, and Married with Children and shows like that. It was that the focus was on, you know, it wasn't the big question. The focus of the comedy for the most part wasn't on the big existential questions or government. It was on family drama and that, and there was more of a homey, cozy kind of vibe to it. Maybe that's not so much the case now. We've got,
I
you
have your
know,
enthusiasm.
we got, yeah, we I think we've gotten a little bit better at satire in the last decade or so, especially with Curb Your Enthusiasm and Seinfeld,
Right, yeah.
and stuff like that. But anyway, not to get too off on a t tangent
Oh no,
off on a
well, let me
tangent here,
finish
but
that
you're
tangent that
yeah, yeah, yeah go ahead, go ahead, yeah.
when The Life of Brian came out and I strenuously that for many years has been the first movie I recommend to anybody who wants to know about cults, because you are dealing with intellectuals who graduated from Oxford or Cambridge universities, who are actually, when you get underneath what they're saying, are making most of the points you can make about the inanity of authoritarian cult groups. But there was a storm of criticism for Life of Brian. Bishops went on the television attacking it, and they pointed out that, in fact, they hadn't said anything about Jesus, and there isn't. There's just a bit of the Sermon on the Mount at the beginning, where they think he's blessing the cheesemakers. But that's it. The rest of it's about Brian. It's about Brian. And it's about the way people believe. Follow the shoe, no, follow the gourd. And when they were so severely criticized, they made a public statement, and that was, we're told to the effect of, we're told that we have offended Christians, and we'd like to apologize because we meant to offend people of all religions. And I think that point, we have to be honest. And sometimes that means being unpleasant. Sometimes, I mean, I was told off, two of my counselor friends, about 3 years ago. We did a show about this ludicrous woman who's written these books that are just like, it's the color of everything that matters, you know. And so you'll have a happy life if you eat yellow food. And so,
Heard of
as my friend, brilliant friend Mitch Beattie put it, when an ex-Scientologist said, I've got this brilliant system, you just eat food that's a right color and you are totally enlightened and healthy. And he said, so food dye would be top on your shopping list, right?
that.
And
Oh no, it's artificial. It doesn't work.
well, you see, it needn't be artificial. It could be beetroot juice, for example, if you wanted red. That's perfectly natural. Annatto for yellow, that's a natural coloring, you know. So it can be done, Anthony. Don't despair. You too can dye your food whatever color you like and become
There's hope yet.
Buddha.
There's hope. There's hope for us all. Wow. It's so simple.
Yeah.
Yeah,
So
who knows?
it's a difficult one.
What
So
you said of
the thing is, be who you are, and don't get too
Yeah.
prissy about the rules of how to do things. Whether we approach, I mean, many years ago, my dear friend Jerry Armstrong, when I first met him, he made this statement to people that I said, well, in Scientology, you have a gradient scale, you know, you give people the bite-sized pieces and get them to the place so they understand. And he said, no, you dump everything on them and it's a quantum leap. I'm not sure that why quantum leaping came into it, but let people work it out. Give them the information. Don't treat them as children to some
Yeah.
extent. So there is this balance, and I'm not, I agree with you. We do have to give people things at the right rate.
Well, what
But
you said about Life of Brian, I think makes my point, because the reaction to it only served to bolster the argument it was making, right? The
absolutely.
satirical point, the point. It reminds me of The Golden Compass. I remember when that movie came out. Based on the book series, and
By the
I
famous
haven't read the book,
atheist.
right? Yeah, but and from what I understand about the book, it's pretty explicit in terms of the bad guy is the bad guys are the church or the Anglican church and everything. They're the authoritarian religious group. And I remember there was just so much when that movie was coming out in my community, there was so much uproar and so much anger over it. And I was, you know, obviously I was like, oh, that's a, you know, evil movie. I'm not going to watch it. That was the mindset. But later on, I ended up watching it. And it's like any Harry Potter Chronicles of Narnia story. There's nothing all the criticism. I don't know if the book's any different, but it's all very subtle and well done satire. It's not it doesn't have the sense of propaganda at all. And that's what we were told, right? It's just propaganda, but it's just a good story that. And that's the main intention of the work, right? Is to be a compelling story, and in addition to it, the author has all this metaphor and symbolism relating to the authoritarian nature of the church with this whatever the organization's called in those books. And when you have measured, careful criticism, like you always do. You always, you know, show your receipts, do your homework. You're the master at that, at backing up everything you say with research, and you have to have that approach as well. But you also have to have the approach of, you know, acknowledging the other person's experience as well, and saying as many things like, I know you felt that way because of this, but and that approach is so much more effective because the backlash that will respond will be that the backlash you'll get will be so much more clearly less rational, more emotional, just like happened with the reaction to Life of Brian and Golden Compass. And the trad recovery group, some hardcore trad Catholic YouTubers recently became aware of this conference that they're hosting. The fact that this is even a thing, that there's even a movement of people who grew up in trad Catholicism who are speaking out. And I've talked about this on my Dragons of Victory channel. They're just releasing videos where they're just apoplectic and clutching their pearls and all they can say is, this is demonic, this is evil, this is of the devil, and just on and on like that. And they're just proving our point so well in their reaction. And we almost have to just sit back and say, look at this.
There's a documentary called Meet the Mormons, and it's one of the best documentaries about authoritarian cult groups I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of them. All they did was they followed Mormon missionaries, so members of the Church of the Latter-day Saints. And they are sent off, I think it's for a two-year period as teenagers, where they're not allowed to communicate at all with their own family, which I think is deeply abusive. I used to meet them because I lived in East Grinstead, which was just 4 miles away from the headquarters of the Latter-day Saints in the UK. So occasionally they'd knock on my door and I'd ask them in, these poor teenagers. And the reason I think this documentary was so successful is there was no commentary. All you saw was what these kids did. And you gradually started seeing there was a guy, an adult who was sat on the edge of the room at all times watching them. And you got the oppressive feeling of this thing. So as you say, such people will blow themselves up. And as you say, I seek to research every statement of fact I make. I'm very careful about that. And sadly, that's still unusual in the waters in which I swim. People want to make allegations and speculate without having evidence to support that, and lives are destroyed along the way because of the kind of rabid intensity of the lynch mob. I seek to stand up against that. That's why I stood up against Scientology, because it was oppressive, because it was harming people. But we do get into a bit of a conundrum if we're talking about, let's say, the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church has history. At the beginning of the 13th century, Pope Innocent III, who is accepted as a pope by the current Catholic Church, declared a genocide. It was the first time that the Catholic Church had engaged upon genocide, and it was to wipe out the Albigensians, or Cathars, as they're called, in the region of the Languedoc, which was an independent country which is now part of France. And they were exterminated, right? They were burned. And, you know, I don't think it's healthy to forget that. I don't think it's healthy to forget the witch trials, the Inquisition, even though the Inquisition was, you know, much of what we read about the Inquisition was written by Protestants attacking it. And there is the idea that perhaps 800 people were sacrificed during the period of the Inquisition. At the same time, about 10,000 witches were burned by Protestants.
Yeah.
All of the wars, all of these things are relevant. What's most relevant, however, within the Christian teaching is the Gospels. And I've just come back from Turkey. And while I was there, I not only saw the Hagia Sophia, which for many centuries was the largest Christian church in the world, but I also went to Nicaea, Iznik as it now is, where in 325 the first church council met. And they formulate, a year after the conversion of the Emperor Constantine, the Roman Emperor, this council met and they put together what's called the Nicene Creed, the Creed of Nicaea. Which begins, "I believe in God the Father, maker of heaven and earth." This creed is shared by the Orthodox, the Catholic, and the Protestant churches. It's about all it is. But they also at this time, and it was, for me, you know, I'm an agnostic, but it, for me, it was a real buzz in going to this place where Christianity was formulated. And sadly, the Basilica, the foundations of the Basilica where these people worshipped, still exists, but it's in the lake now, so you can't actually go there. The closest I could get to it was eating a carp that had been swimming around it, you know, and it was very tasty. So, you know, some spiritual good did come of all of this. But I also went to, there's a little Hagia Sophia Church of the Divine Wisdom in Iznik, in Nicaea, and you're in a building that was begun in the 5th century, and there are all of these centuries of faith. And, you know, there's something quite quite overwhelming about that, the thought of centuries of people believing these things. But one thing that happened at Nicaea, which I think was a bit of a mistake and which we've suffered from ever since, was that the book of the Revelation of St. John the Divine was admitted into the canon of the New Testament. And when we talk about the influence that belief can have, this book has been one of the most influential texts in human history. I would aver that both of the Gulf Wars were fought because of end days Christians who believed that it was time to get the Jews back to Jerusalem, Zion, so that they could convert to Christianity and the end days could come on. Now, we look at that as hopefully vaguely rational human beings, but the thought that Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., and George W. Bush were all end days born again Christians is incredibly relevant. And that all of the billionaires who have the same belief, Tony Blair is a closet Catholic, the people who have come to believe this book, which was not written by St. John, that we can definitely say it's Johannine. That's what the theologians will say. They were followers of the disciple John, but it was not the same person who wrote the Gospel of John, which is the only Gospel written by somebody who knew Jesus, or may have known Jesus if it is genuine. We get into this
It reads like somebody having a psychedelic trip, honestly, the Book of Revelation.
It's more likely, I agree with you, but it's a deliriant trip. It's not a simple LSD hallucinogen trip. This is like ayahuasca or ibogaine or drugs that I would personally go nowhere near, or the Datura that members of the Manson... Tex Watson
DMT.
And Manson family talk. Yeah, DMT is an extract of ayahuasca. So it's really hardcore hallucination. Right. Of course, what we're told by theologians, hermeneutically, is that this book represents Rome and the Diocletian persecution of the late first century, and that there are a whole set of metaphors, but it's taken literally. It was taken literally by Ron Hubbard, who tried to bring the reign of the Antichrist and declared himself the Antichrist in secret teachings. It was what inspired Charles Manson to do what he did. And in every generation, you have people who believe these are the end days, Jesus is coming, this terrible thing that we don't have to worry about global warming, because heck, Jesus is going to be here at any moment. You know,
well, Aleister Crowley too. He thought he was the great. He thought he was the great beast. 666. Right.
Yeah, and Hubbard followed him in performing magical Babylon working in January 1946 with Jack Parsons, Crowley's disciple.
Yeah.
This has been a very influential set of ideas, and here we have a difficulty: can we make fun of it? Ooh, will we upset people? If I'm sure I have upset some people by saying, I don't think it should be in the Bible. I don't think, nor the Book of the Secrets of Enoch, which didn't quite make it, or the Book of Enoch. There are many apocalyptic visions, and they are, as you say, nightmare hallucinations, which have been put forward as scriptural truths. And so therefore, we find ourselves caught in this place where we are meant to be polite about despicable ideas, you know, because they are, you know, enshrined.
Well, you're absolutely correct in all that. They are despicable ideas, and enshrining them doesn't make them any less despicable. And so it's such a tightrope. It's such a balance for me, because I strive for empathy in all things. And I remember how it felt to some degree when I believe these things, and things I would now have no problem mocking as stupid or saying, you know, that's ridiculous. I'll still say that, but I can remember back then certain ideas or certain feelings, maybe not thinking they were stupid, but feeling like I couldn't defend them or like I couldn't make them make sense. But whenever there's in all authoritarian groups, they operate on the one hand seemingly out of love for you, what they say is love for you, and then out of abuse to you or coercion or threatening you, but they'll present it to you in the same package. And whenever they whenever you're confronted with something that doesn't make sense, eventually there's no intellectual way out of this of that conundrum, and the only thing you can do is fall back on your own personal sense of love or your own personal sense of, you know, reliance or dependence on the organization or the church or the belief system. And you very often fall back on memories of your childhood when your parents, when there was something that you didn't want to do or you didn't understand, your parents made you do, and you came out the end of it thanking them or feeling better.
What, you mean
or
you like spinach now?
It's all good. It's all good. I like, you know, that kind of thing helped me overcome stage fright, and now I'm you know, as a kid, you know, but pressure to get me up there. I didn't want to practice piano, and I won that one. I never ended up sticking with it now, and I'm ashamed of that, because I got okay as a kid for a while. Now I've lost all of it. I want to get back to it someday, but that's an instance of where I wish I hadn't given in to my own feelings of dissatisfaction or anything. But that's a legitimate thing in life, very much so. But these groups hijack that and convince you that applies to the spiritual level, that God operates that way. And I just don't think a loving God would operate that way, where you would be that much in the dark and that much the evidence against that the evidence would be that overwhelming, but you're just meant to just simply ignore it and just trust him, just trust us. Mm. But that willingness to like to say, I don't understand it, but because of the trust I have, because of the positive experience and the sense of my own identity related to you, it's almost I'm more than willing to say, you know, to just to, and it feels like it almost feels like a moral good in a way to go like, God's smarter than me, or this organization's smarter than me. That seems humble, right? That seems like you're like a virtuous stance in their world. And that's the tricky aspect of all of this to puncture through. Mm. Is to because my fear is you know, turning people off by starting to attack that sense of like that sense of who they are and that sense of their own personal judgment and certain belief. Like I would say to someone, maybe like, again, unless they're going out in the world and enacting their beliefs mm-hmm. destructively, I would say, this is how I feel about that belief. Mm-hmm. I think it's ridiculous, but I understand that you don't think it is. And I think, you know, most rational, most normal Catholics or Christians, there's certain beliefs that of theirs where they would be able to acknowledge, yeah, I can see why you wouldn't think it would make sense. And I can't really explain it to you, but this is just, and that's, there's so many things like that. There's so many issues where it's like, I can't explain this. I can't make it make sense to you, but because it makes me feel good, and because I trust the person saying this, I'm going to believe it. Mm. And when you get down to that, there's really nothing you can say. There's no, you can't continue the argument in terms of you know, a back and forth dialogue, because now we're getting into questions of self identity and mm-hmm. questions of deep of emotional needs and personal needs. Yep. And you can't, it's like nobody converts to Christianity or Catholicism because they're reading a book and they like add things together. It's like, it's not an act. I almost never, it's never like an academic thing when you convert to Christianity because you read a book and that convinced you. You have an experience. Anyway, not to go off too long in here, but the point I'm trying to make is it's such a minefield to navigate sometimes, because when somebody has a belief that they can't defend, but they also aren't doing anything with it in a sense, I don't know what to do with that. And I don't know what to do with that person other than say, all right, then I guess we'll just part this way and go about
agree
our lives.
Agree to differ. I think that I'm going to pick you up on the point of humility, which I have often said, I understand the meaning of the word, and I hope to have some one day. I've been working at it. But I do think we should have humility, but humility is where I say, I don't understand, it's bigger than me. It's not where I say, so I'll therefore believe what you say. You have authority. Mm-hmm. You know, you must know what you're talking mm-hmm. about. That is authoritarianism. Whenever we subscribe mm-hmm. to a belief because we are told it's true, but we don't know that it's true, then we have become authoritarian in our beliefs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important. The other thing that I think is vitally important, and which I also bang on about and repeat frequently, is what William James called the feelings of knowing. And that if you can get somebody to think about that rather than thinking about what they're sure they know, then it may help them to think differently. And, you know, the example I always give, I was 17. I spent 2 hours talking to a born again Christian who wanted to convert me, and he backed away. You know, I was perfectly polite to him. I was very nice. I didn't ridicule him in any way. And I don't normally in direct conversations. You know, I try to be attentive to somebody's needs when talking with them. So I put various points to him, like, you know, where does Jesus claim to be the Son of God. And of course, he doesn't. There isn't a point where he ever makes that. He says, the Father and I are one. But it's John the Baptist who hears a voice saying, this is my only begotten Son. It's not Jesus who says it. And later, of course, when Jesus is brought news of John the Baptist's death, he makes the comment of the messenger, not that I believe the words of men. And I think that's a very interesting statement. We should not believe the words of men. We should be careful. We should, in fact, like, you know, he allowed Thomas to check the holes. This is a man who'd known him for a couple of years and says, I don't recognize you. And rather than saying, well, you've got to have faith, you've got to believe in me, he says, here, check it out. And I think there is, you know, there's this rational thread that runs through. But this guy walked back away from me and he said to me, I don't understand the Bible, but I know it's all true. Now, those are feelings of knowing. And we all do it. We're all certain of things. You know, the German-speaking world, what was it, somewhere 93%, maybe more, of all the people in Austria and Germany voted to no longer have the vote because they believed in the Führer, the leader. And they proved to be wrong. He misled them, whichever way we go. And that giving away our authority over ourselves in any circumstance, and so returning that to people and entering into a conversation. I mean, I'm saying that generally, I think we have to be careful about censorship, because I live in a country that relinquished that form of censorship in the 1720s. We are able to have much more open conversations in this country. We don't have to be so careful. And I think that's because of satire. I think it's because we don't take that attitude. It also means that, yes, you look at movements like, say, the Pentecostalists in the United States. These are movements that were founded by people who are quite obviously frauds. They're one after another, you know, Branham, for example. They are terrible people. Go and look at John Collins' brilliant work on this subject. I had a chat with him as well, which you can find on the channel here. But these guys wanted to be incredibly rich and powerful. And I'm kind of going, but didn't Jesus say you can worship God or mammon, which means money? You, one or the other, not both. You can't get a camel through the eye of a needle. Rich people don't go to heaven. And this bothered me as a schoolboy, that I was at a school.
What was the one time Jesus got physical? The one time Jesus got physical.
Throwing the moneylenders out of the temple.
Moneylenders,
Exactly. And so as a child, I saw that people weren't following this stuff. And yeah, you get into this terrible trouble. It's like, you know, they're saying, well, you know, it's Friday and you've got to eat fish. I'm quite happy to eat fish. As I said, the carp from the lake was delicious. But this, all of these rules, like, you know, when the Amish started secretly reading the Bible because they can't read because it's old High German or something. So only their elders can read it. And they found there was nothing about which way you cross your suspenders. In the same way that when Tyndale translated the Bible into English, people found there were no monks, no nuns, no priests. Where did all this come from? And so we get this construction. So getting people to a point where they can have humor about their beliefs. You know, I don't have any problem ribbing my Christian friends, and they don't have any problem with me doing it, you know, because their belief is firm and they don't feel in the least bit threatened by my jollity. But on the other hand, there are people who do. And, you know, I'm again going to refer to Mitch, who I haven't seen for 25 years or something. But one of the points he made, very clever man, was how could you be happy in heaven knowing that anybody was in hell? And when I put this to a friend of mine who's a Russian Orthodox believer, and again, a remarkable man, he was very embarrassed. And he said, you have to read C.S. Lewis on that point, who was a Protestant. But I did get the book. I just haven't got to it yet. But so there are certain basic ideas. And once people become angry or phobic when their beliefs are questioned, we know that we're dealing with authoritarianism, because You can challenge any of my beliefs. I'm not going to scream at you because you disagree with me. I'm going to say, oh, that's really interesting. That, you might have a point. Let's talk about that some more. Bringing that attitude of mind about in children, rather than at 4 years old saying, who made you? God made me, and instilling these ideas in, bringing about intelligent disobedience, as my friend Ira Chela calls it, courageous followership, as Ira calls it, where we are in a society where we're allowed to express our opinions, we're allowed to have controversial opinions, and we are allowed to demand answers rather than just being fobbed off with, oh, the good book says you've got to do this, actually get some answers. And I agree, we're on a razor's edge that if we say the wrong thing to somebody and they stop listening, we didn't get anywhere. But on the other hand, a pineapple? You're kidding me. The rest of it I'm willing to believe, but the pineapple's just too much.
Well, the big benefit of doing your best to stay on that razor's edge and to stay on that tightrope is the other side will definitely not. And so, like I said earlier, when they respond their way, it very often demonstrates, like, I don't think, maybe there's someone out there, but I don't think there's a single person out there who looks at those Scientology hate videos and legitimately is swayed by them or convinced by them because they are so cartoonishly overdone, right? And all they do is just bolster the proof of bolster the case of everybody criticizing them. And it was very similar in the response that the Tradcats had to they haven't really responded much to my content because it hasn't gotten big enough yet for them to notice. But my friend Kevin Nontradicath and Laura Vandervoss, they've gotten more traffic. And this whole last couple of weeks, there was this whole the some Tradcath YouTubers were just throwing this apoplectic fit and only made the conference more popular and got more attention to it. And now all we really had to do is go like, see? And so there's the benefit of remaining nuanced is that the people who don't think the extremists, the authoritarians, the people who operate in that black and white world will dig in and expose themselves. And I wanted to also you mentioned I think a whole a key issue here with I don't understand the Bible, but I know it's true, and all that's a sense of feeling of knowing, and also, but at the same time, the question of these contradictions of we're supposed to love our neighbor, we're supposed to, religion and this faith, all what we're doing is about bringing people together and strengthening community, and yet it seems to only cause us to divide us and cause us to
And the
fight all
first
throughout
recorded
human history.
genocide is in the book of Joshua, I believe, as to loving people. That this is where every man, woman, and child is killed by the Hebrews. It's a little
Human.
difficult, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We humans, I would say, are just desperate for answers. We're desperate to know why we're here. And all throughout our history, we need to understand that in terms of human history, we're at a very unique time in terms that we have the comfort, the time, the resources, and the ability to really research, to actually learn as much about the world as we want to.
And
For
instead, we
most of
waste
human.
our time on YouTube. Oh,
Yeah,
sad.
exactly. What am I doing? I need to go outside. But anyway, the point I was trying to make is we had to operate through sacrifice out of necessity for most of human history. That's how we had to sacrifice in order to live. We had to endure great hardship since the caveman days in order to
I'm not
build
sure there
up.
were any caveman days personally, but let's not get into
Sort of
hominid
Neanderthal
history.
days, early man, whatever you want to say. It's been thousands and thousands of years of toil and hardship to
Yeah, I don't
achieve.
agree with you. I absolutely
Oh,
don't agree
really?
with you.
To shave
My,
this world? Well, I'm
that
talking about in terms of
I think in terms of the historical past, to a large extent, what you say is true. For the 2 million years before that, from Homo erectus onward, they don't seem to have had that difficult a life. And hunter-gatherer societies are not sacrificing themselves. That they do, you know, look at the Baka pygmy in the Congo. They sit around having a good laugh most of the time. So I think the you know, certainly when the imperial states rose up, so you know, starting with Sumeria in about what, 3,500 BC, from that time onwards, and with the principle that you have God, the king or president, the boss who tells you what to do, which we've inherited, that society is bad. But I definitely recommend At the Dawn of Everything by Graeber and Wengrow to give a completely different perspective and an accurate perspective. This is an anthropologist and archaeologist showing that many human societies have actually been, like the Indus Valley civilization lasted for 700 years in what is now Pakistan, without warfare, without, it would appear, religion, without kings, and they managed to live peacefully. So I think,
Well,
and
thank you for no, thank you so much for that clarification. That's important that we get the proper historical context here. For me, I was going in my mind, I was going back to like the Aztecs and the ancient Israelites, you know, with their culture of sacrifice. The idea being that the cosmos operates on a barter system, an exchange system. That's how God expects you to operate in the same way you operate with each other and with the outside world. You
And
know,
Wisley
you have to
Pochtley will
sacrifice.
not bring the sun up if you don't give him some human hearts to eat, which
Right,
is fair enough.
exactly.
You know, they could have been right about that.
Yeah, but I think we've gotten to the point where we've established society, we've established community to a degree. And you're right. Maybe we should, the hunter gatherers are onto something. Maybe we overcomplicate things, and there's something to be said about that
And
more.
nomads, yeah.
That there's something to be said about that. I completely agree. But now we've gotten to the point where we're definitely not doing much better, mental health wise, you know,
We're
across the
doing
world.
progressively worse in many ways, though it is reckoned that the period into the early 60s was the worst mental health period that British psychiatric reports. One of the arguments about the cannabis that has been made is that it makes people mentally ill, and it's been pointed out that in fact mental health has improved since cannabis came into Western society. I don't think the two things are necessarily correlated, but that's where I came across the statistics saying, but we are now recognizing ever more forms of neurodivergence, and we are seeing that again. If we look to these so-called primitive societies, they don't have anxiety disorders, they don't have depression. These are things that belong to society since civilization came along, and since the pressures of and the oppression of a society where there are a few people. In the US, you have a bizarre political system where you have plutocracy, you have the rule by the rich, and the rich can determine what the government does by saying, oh, we'll withdraw our factories if you don't do what we want. And so we see a very small amount of people with a huge amount of power and the pretense of democracy. And I'm not talking about communism or socialism, I'm talking about democracy, saying, you know, if you don't have $1 billion, you haven't got a chance of being president. That's it's not quite that bad in Europe, but you know, something because of a belief in free enterprise, because of a belief that hardships come to people because of it's their own fault, that we're all the captains of our own ships, which is a ridiculous notion. We get a political system that comes out of these beliefs, which, as you say, and I would say that sacrifice is still fundamental. Sadly, you know, what is happening in Ukraine, what is happening in Gaza, which is being sponsored by the whole world, you know, the money of the world, that is sacrifice. That's like, you know,
It is fundamental to the human condition, but I don't see how
and
it's
we don't have to be
coherent
that
that it
way.
would be it's undoubtedly fundamental to the human condition because of the limited amount of resources on this planet. You know, if we lived in Shangri-La, I don't think that necessarily
Well, I think if we didn't
would
run the
need it. Well,
military, we'd have enough for everything, wouldn't we? You
that's
know,
a fair
I'm
point. Fair
told
point
that
as well.
it'll
Yeah.
take $1 billion to rebuild Gaza,
Yeah.
and
Yeah.
Joe Biden has just led. What they're giving $16 billion in weapons to the people who've performed the genocide. That's what the International Court, the United Nations, have called it. So you're going, well, if we hadn't, you know, the Iraq War cost $1 million to devastate a country completely. If that money had been
Yeah.
spent on health and welfare in the third world, there wouldn't be a third world. So I think the sacrifice is us using our resources for absolutely the wrong things, you know,
Yeah.
pointing them towards the wrong things, where we should be bringing a justice system which is incorruptible for the whole world, where, you
Yeah.
know, law enforcement wouldn't be, you know, the men in blue or the women in blue as well, separated off as a cult from the rest of society, justifying each other, where there would
Yeah.
be real education rather than this nonsense that kids are being taught in schools these days. Kids would
Yeah.
learn about relationship, they'd learn about communication, they'd learn about how to have a rational discussion, they'd learn about courageous followership, intelligent
Yeah.
disobedience, these kind of things. These are all things which in our generation could happen. We have all the
Yeah.
tools in the toolbox, and instead we are, you know, screaming our way down the highway to hell.
Absolutely
Because
right.
of authoritarianism and because of our political
Yeah.
systems,
Yeah, I would
because we
say
don't
if
ridicule them hard enough.
I would
Oh, I
say
see
if I
what
could
you
Chris if
mean.
I spitting image, I'm a fan of that, a fan of that show. Sometimes I'm not as tuned into British politics as I should be, so the jokes are a bit over my head. But whenever they make fun of Trump or American, I'm on board with it. I get it a lot more. I would say the point I could make here I was in my rambling way, if I could narrow it down and crystallize it,
You've
I would
not
say that, say I've got
you've
an
not
answer.
rambled at any point, Anthony. You've been straight to the point throughout our conversation. So,
Thank you, I appreciate that. I was just going to say that if, say, I have an ant farm, I can't expect any kind of barter type relationship, this for that quick relationship with the ants in my ant farm. They might have some kind of relationship with each other, but I'm on a completely different level as them in terms of being able to even operate in a sense where I could get anything from them, and they or and in that sense. But that seems to be the way God, the creator of the universe, seems to be operating with us. It's like God's like, I'm going to make myself an ant farm, but I'm going to love these ants. They're going to be made in my image. They're going to be like my children. But at the same time, I'm going to, especially in recent years, right, I'm going to be completely silent to them, and my only communication will be this third person, this middleman figure, who's just as flawed, no different in any way than the rest of them, but he's the guy I've chosen to be my messenger. And that whole system of you have of expecting a sacrifice to him, of expecting to live in a way where, it's like on that again, that barter system, that this for that. The barter system, I think, emerged out of, human necessity, as or out of a desire, maybe out of a sense to, build, like you said, maybe that was the beginning of moving from hunter gatherers to the empire. Maybe it was the moment when they realized, hey, we can trade, we can barter,
Well,
and
no, the
that idea.
nomads traded for millennia before the rise of the cities, the civilitas, the civilization, and the
I'm just trying to be a history
agricultural
detective
state.
here. I'm just trying to be a put my history detective hat on. But no, yeah, it just is not coherent to me that a loving creator would impose that kind of sacrificial barter system rules when he has the complete authority and power. Again, going back to me and my ant farm, I can feed these ants. I can take care of them. I can put things in them for them to crawl around. I can order it to where the ants can be as productive and flourishing as they want. Or I could pour hydrogen peroxide down them, or I could shake them up, or I could, kick down their anthill or something. I could operate that way. I have the complete power to do so. And both, it seems like with natural disasters and the meteor that hit the dinosaurs, it seems like there's plenty of shaking of the ant farm going on with us, but yet we still have to. That's the key issue for me, is that the way this God is presented is just not, the pieces just don't fit together. Because my ex what I understand of love is just a selfless giving. Like, I don't need anything from you. You're if you try, for me, true love, I guess it for me is that it is to will their good, right? To not want any to sometimes tough love is a thing. I'm not going to say it never is. Sometimes you, but you have to, again, the balance of power here. That's the key issue. The balance of power is skewed, and the when I have far more power over something, be it ants, animals, small children, whatever, I have so much more responsibility
We should
to take care of them, and that it just doesn't seem to be reciprocated at all with how this version of God is presented.
No, I think that's true, and there is so much that could be said, but Maimonides in the Guide of the Perplexed, written in the 11th century, opens by saying, when Genesis says that man is created in the image of God, it does not mean physically. It means, if we extrapolate from that, we have imagination, as God does. The other animals do not, as far as we know, have imagination, not even the whales and the other primates. As far as we know, they don't have imagination. We also have language, which allows us to share our imagination. And if you think back to the God, I was thinking this yesterday, it just struck me, it does from time to time, that if you think back to the God of the Middle Ages, that God presided over seven planets and the sun was going around the earth. It's a very tiny world. There were, what, half a billion people, perhaps, maybe less than that. And that was it. Now, with Hubble and his discoveries at the end of the 19th century and on, the universe is, just this galaxy, 100,000 million stars. How many planets? How many conscious entities? How many intellectually developed civilizations are there? Because then you've got, oh no, how many galaxies? Ooh. 100,000 million galaxies going off to what might just as well be infinity. And God, therefore, has grown from being in charge of seven planets, only one of them inhabited, to now being in charge of billions of planets. So God is much bigger in the modern imagination than he was in the Middle Ages, certainly much bigger than he was at the time when the New Testament was written. And the daughter of the Old Testament was written. So, and that for me is an interesting idea. And I do go head more towards the kind of Joseph Campbell view, though he was a flawed man, but a brilliant man nonetheless, which is that we're dealing with, I, since I was a kid, I walked away from belief in a personal deity, a personified deity at the age of 13. Never made sense to me since then, but I'm not an atheist, I'm an agnostic. But I, at 17, discovered the Chinese principle of the Tao, this idea that there is something out of which the universe emerges that we don't understand. And we give it this name, Tao, meaning that which I do not understand, and it stays there. Campbell will help then point to Dharma, the concept within Buddhism of a way, which Tao is sometimes translated as, or Ma'at. In the old Egyptian system, there is an underlying force. I think these ideas have fascinated me for life. So if I ridicule somebody for feeding pineapples to dinosaurs, you know, that's another matter. I take the religious thinking and mysticism deeply seriously, as with Eric, my great hero Eric Fromm. I am an agnostic mystic. I am somebody who is in pursuit of truth and as yet has not found any. You know, I have estimations of what is more probable, what is less probable, what is extraordinarily unlikely. Pineapples, come on, it's not going to happen. But I have my path there. When I deal with people who are certain and they know, you know, what is and which book we ought to read and what we ought to do, I get worried. You know, that if we can't talk about it, if we can't think about it, if we can't say, I have this set of metaphors in which I live, you have that set of metaphors in which you live, how can we bring those things together? If those beliefs lead people towards what you are calling love, and I love the Christian differentiation between agape and caritas and eros and the different forms of love. That's very interesting. But to give and not to count the cost, I think, is the Christian expression that you're
Basically,
looking
yeah.
at as fundamentally that. I think that love, I don't believe in self-love. I don't think that's a good idea. I never have. I think self-hate is similarly a horrid and stupid idea, that we have to reconcile ourselves with ourselves. But to love others is not to give selflessly. I think the St. Francis idea in Catholicism is the wrong idea. And look where it got him. He was 44 years old when he died, and apologized to the donkey, as he called his body. I think that love is where you don't harm yourself and do everything you can to help others, and where you don't harm others. And I think this idea of sacrificing yourself for others, it's like when you're in an airplane, you put the oxygen mask on you before you put it on the child, because otherwise something really bad could happen. And I think it's a very important idea, that the Christian religion becomes one of terrible tyrants, generation upon generation, tyrants who order people to believe and live in a certain way. So two of the popes, you know, you would go to hell, I'm afraid, just looking at you right now, you would go to hell. Two popes excommunicated anyone who wore a beard. Sorry, you're gone.
We're going, yeah. It's too
So
late.
these tyrannies, which have been elected, instead of people going to the core of the doctrine and saying, love your neighbor as yourself, which I'm personally not going to do, but because as I say, I don't believe in self-love, so you know that puts me in a difficult situation. But to live a compassionate life, to live a life where you seek to help others, where you seek to better the world,
Yeah.
if people's religion tends them in that direction, then it's fine. I don't care, you know, the flying spaghetti monster probably does exist, frankly. And we should be Pastafarians, all of us. But if what you believe, as you said fairly near the beginning of our conversation, if what you believe leads you to do harm to others, and to promulgate harmful ideas, so a religious idea, the Aryan race theory, there's a religious
Yeah.
idea. What we believe is extremely important, and because how we behave comes out of what we believe. And therefore, to challenge these beliefs and to try and get people to the point, educate people to the point where they don't mind having their beliefs challenged, where they're willing for somebody to say, well, I don't think Jesus ever existed. I think you made him up. And
Yeah.
they're willing to go, well, I think he existed because, and you know, you go to my friend James Beverly, who'll show you know, well, in 60 AD this happened and this happened, and there is this evidence. And then you might go to Josephus and say, but this is the only evidence from his own time
Yeah.
outside of his followers. And he's saying he was one of 18 messiahs who walked the earth in that generation before Titus and his mates went and savaged all of Israel and Judea. So it's interesting, isn't it? It's how we tailor the message, who we tailor the message to, how honest we are. You know, is it manipulative to actually limit the message to people so that they're only hearing what will be attractive to them? Are we manipulating people? Have we got a hidden agenda ourselves because we want to convert them to our way of thinking? There are a lot of thoughts there.
I can see why that would be an issue, a concern about being manipulated. I think, though, you also have to think of it from the sense of you kind of have to judge where the other person's coming from. In a way, you have to judge because I think that if you get a sense that the person you're engaging with is not a good faith actor or is not interested in is not coming at this from the perspective of actually having their beliefs challenged, if you can just get a sense of the person's intent, and that can determine how you respond to them and how you and I think that that's not manipulative. That's just, responding in kind, because if somebody's coming at, so you brought up the old church taught that the earth went around the sun, and there was a
The
pope,
sun went round the
Alex,
earth.
the sun went around the earth. Geocentrism, right? The cosmic model that Galileo disproved, and
Copernicus
of course
before him, in fact, but
Copernicus before him, right?
and of
But
course
Galileo,
the Greeks had already done it, but whatever.
yeah, the church, it took them a little while to catch up,
Well,
but
by the time Galileo actually made his pronouncement of the revolution, giving us the word revolution to mean something other than going round, the Pope had already accepted that this doctrine was fine. That this we are taught the wrong things in our school books. The reason that Galileo was shown the instruments of torture was because he knew the Pope, and he'd been warned not. And this is very pertinent to our conversation. He'd been warned not to ridicule the Pope, and in his book, The Revolution, he called the Pope Buffo, the idiot, and had his. And that was why he was shown the instruments of torture, not because he's, Copernicus had already said, the earth goes round the sun. And wasn't a matter of great concern. It's been made that because of what Voltaire said about it in the 18th century. But it gets fairly complicated. I was talking about
Absolutely.
the Aryan race theory, and that this is an idea that infects tens of thousands of people around the world who still believe it. And they believe that they belong to a superior white culture, the Aryan culture. Now, when we trace this belief back, it does have a point of origin. In the 1880s, Madame Helena Blavatsky came up with the idea that the inhabitants of Atlantis, who she called the Aryans, borrowing a word from linguists who were talking about the Indo-European language and talking about the people who originated that being Aryans, she's not talking about that. She's making it sound scientific by using the word. She says that the people of Atlantis miscegenated, bred with the people of Lemuria, another non-existent
Made up
place.
place.
Yeah. And I mean, it may be Atlantis is first mentioned by Plato, and it was probably a reference to Crete, which had a
That's what I think,
tsunami. But who knows? But she takes this idea and says they miscegenated. They bred with lesser beings, and in so doing, they lost their supernatural powers. This is picked up. I mean, she is the first person to be investigated by the British Society for Psychical Research, which was co-founded by the psychologist William James. And she's the first person that they investigate, and they pronounce her an absolute fraud based upon visiting her in India and seeing what she was doing. Soon enough, her house burns down before the physical proof of her fraud can be revealed. And the special cabinet she used, which was, had trick drawers in it, which they found, and all of this. So she's a fraud, and yet she has this profound influence. These ideas are picked up by two Austrians called Liszt and Lanz, if I remember rightly, both of whom got themselves adopted into baronial families so they could have the title von. And they put this thing forward at a time in the Austro-Hungarian Empire where there was a tremendous division between the various cultures. So you've got the Slavic culture, and Pan-Slavism, which is the other side of Aryanism, still exists. Putin is a Pan-Slav. He is trying to bring back, just as Hitler tried to create a Germanic empire, Putin is trying to do this. It's called neo-traditionalism. It's Dugin is its ideologue. It's an amazingly bizarre system. It wants to return all of the Slavic peoples to about the 15th century. It wants serfdom back. All of this stuff is written into it. That's the one set of ideas. We've still got the Aryans on the other side, the so-called neo-Nazis. Now, this stupidity led to the Annenerbe, the ministry led by Heinrich Himmler, which had 50 divisions, which were trying to prove that this was scientific fact. Now, we now have DNA testing. And while we can't be necessarily sure that when it says you're part Latvian, part what have you, how accurate these are, because they're based on modern measures. So we need to be careful about that. But they can say you've got genes from every form of human, other human being. You've got genes probably from Neanderthals, a little bit in our mix because our ancestors were, well, not choosy, what can I say? and we are, all of us, to some extent, this intermixture. So we get a ridiculous idea, which we could call a religious idea, that there are these Aryan people. And what Himmler was trying to do through the Lebensborn, where SS handsome blonde SS officers would have sex with handsome blonde women, their children were going to reacquire the electron powers of the Aryan peoples. They were going to have supernatural powers, which is, you know, so you get this ridiculous set of beliefs and people who become fixed in their, you know, no, this is the truth, you know. So you get people who are going to great rallies with swastikas all over them and telling their four-year-old children that they belong, you know, they have a white identity and all of this kind of stuff. I had the great pleasure of talking with Calvin Pierce a couple of times, whose dad was the head of the American Nazis, and whose book, The Sins of My Father, is an amazing read in terms of understanding that mentality. But so beliefs become behaviors. That was the point. That was the, you know, where I was going with that.
Well, yeah, and you're absolutely right. And so beliefs do become behaviors. And so the issue we're grappling is when do you confront someone's belief in order to prevent or to undo bad behavior that they're doing? And when do you say leave them alone when their beliefs are you know, are false, but ultimately and not like there's the Raelians, who were this alien UFO group led by this
I was
pop
I was
star
verbally
who,
assaulted by the head of the Raelians on a television show in 2012
by Rael himself.
No, by the head of the Raelians in Britain.
Oh, okay,
you
okay.
Say I'm a cult. I hadn't said anything. I hadn't said a word.
Well, no, I think that they are undoubtedly a cult, but the question is that are they a destructive one? Because
exactly,
they are openly bizarre, but I've looked into them because I felt like, well, there must be something, because so many of these groups but I have yet, and it's the same thing with the Aetherius Society, like both of those UFO groups. Weird, but I can't see anything necessarily harmful or destructive in what they do. They seem to be overall having a good time. On the surface level, as far as I can tell, I'm sure there's, you know, there's obviously going to be some control issues. Some in any organization, there's going to be issues. I just don't know how intrinsic it is to that.
The Flat Earth Society will, you know, provide a good example. What harm are they doing telling people that the Earth is flat? They're just having a good time.
Yeah, I mean, if you, it's you don't want astronauts or engineers who are flat earthers, you know, you don't want people who are, you know, you don't want the head of NASA to be a flat earther. So I think
that'd be a good idea, actually. We'd spend a lot less money, wouldn't we?
Yeah, just he's like, what's the point? We're not going to do anything anymore. So, but I wanted to go back to what you said about the geocentric model in Galileo, because I've talked about this before, and this is such a perfect, because again, say you met somebody who right now who was like, yeah, I think that the sun goes around the earth and the earth is still.
That's
and I believe
society.
That not because I think it makes any scientific sense, but because of the authority of the Catholic Church. There's
Joshua
a lot of
made the sun stand still. It's in the Bible.
Yeah,
and we didn't
exactly
go flying
no, no,
off.
No. There is a geocentric strand, a strain of traditional Catholics. Most traditional Catholics, I would say, would on it, if you were to ask them, they would say, "Oh, well, yeah. I mean, the church, yeah, Galileo, that wasn't so great. Like, yeah, the sun, the Earth goes around the sun." They would accept the heliocentric model, but there's a select few of them. The more hardcore you get, again, the deeper into the belief system you get. There's a movie that was made called The Principle by this guy Robert Sugenis, who's a traditional Catholic lawyer who's who believes in the geocentric model of the universe, and he tricked people like Lawrence Krauss and Michio Kaku to appear in his movie, and they didn't know what they didn't fully get what they were doing or being interviewed for until the movie came out. But that was to give the film an air of credibility to him, you
Of
know,
course, yeah.
and even the narrator of the movie, the actress they hired to narrate the movie, I think it was Patricia Heaton, she came out and said, "I renounce this. I renounce this movie as well." So
I didn't realize what I
everyone,
was reading.
yeah, I don't know how that one works, but pretty much everyone except the creator of the movie who had anything to do with it has since denounced it. But the point of that movie is that it is to promote the you know Galileo was wrong and the Copernicus was wrong and the church's original model was correct. And one thing they'll point to that is official church documents. I know that you said that the church never actually said that, but like definitively. But the thing is about the traditional Catholics are so the idea of the unchangeable authority of the church is baked into them, and it's like whatever the church said, if it was ex cathedra, solemnly defined dogma, the Pope doesn't have to necessarily everything he says isn't necessarily true. That's why they can get
Doctrine of
away with their
infallibility.
criticism of Pope Francis. Yeah, their liability. If we like it, it's official. But that movie, and I think Robert Sugenis himself has pointed out that there is, and I actually, when I pulled it up, there is an official papal bull that Pope Alexander,
What year
what's
does
the,
it date to? Because my understanding is it's after Galileo, not before.
yeah, I think it was after Galileo, but after his death. So you were right. I wasn't saying that you were right in the sense that that was not the reason for his torture, or
No,
was
he
he was
wasn't
shown the
tortured. He was
instruments of torture.
shown the instruments of torture.
Right,
Here they
he
are.
was
We'll
shown
do
the
this to
instruments of
you.
torture.
And he was then
Yeah,
moved into a
that.
house next to the nunnery that his daughter
Yeah.
headed so that he could
Which
see her.
it's okay to threaten people, I guess, but just not to actually follow through. You know that's
I'm not
because that's
sure. I
literally in
think,
that.
yeah, no.
I'm not saying you're saying that. I'm not saying you're saying that. But that's literally the argument that they would make. Like in that movie, they said Galileo, it's a myth he was tortured, and they had sort of the attitude of like Mythbuster time, but they just
Nobody
said
said
no,
he
he was
was
just shown the.
tortured, yeah.
Yeah, but they just said no, he was shown the instruments of torture, and it's like okay, well that doesn't really. I mean, the Catholic Church definitely had those. Why did they even have those in the first place? You know that what that's the question to
Oh,
ask
somebody
yourself.
came round and sold them to us, and we got a good price on them, so we thought we'll get some instruments of torture, you
Yeah,
know. Yeah, look, another issue, which is the Big Bang, that of course, Georges
Catholic
Lemaitre.
priest came up with that.
Yeah, it was a Catholic priest, and he spent 3 days convincing Einstein. What's more, there's a papal bull in the 1950s which says, yeah, you can be a Catholic and believe in the Big Bang. It's not a problem. So, you know, yeah, here we
Yeah.
are in canon law. It does get a little bit complex at times, but.
But that's a weapon that they have as well. In that they can, there's so much. Same thing with all these groups is there's so much lore and so much definitions and just endless that you can argue with them and you can, you know, get a little detail wrong and they can jump on that as, see, you don't know what you're talking about. And they can any sort of error you make in a date or a time period or whatever is because they spend all their time reading this stuff and knowing all of it that and so there's a feeling you get where you have to necessarily match their knowledge when you're discussing with them. And I think to an extent you do have to, but at the same time I think that you shouldn't necessarily be forced to play their game. You
No,
know
and
what I
you have
mean?
to
Yeah.
understand that in logic, that people who split hairs or have sex with ants, which the Dutch say in a much ruder way, that that it's just a method of disputation. It's not a method of reasoning. And if somebody is coming at you with that, I mean, obviously, I'm relatively fact rich compared to most people. I have this strange accumulative memory. And so
we all appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. And it's sometimes useful, but when somebody is going down that route of, you know, what did Jesus say? Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy strength. That's the whole thing. That's the whole thing. And it comes from the Rabbi Hillel, who challenged a legalist, as they're called, a Pharisee, who was saying, you know, and he said, can you stand on one leg and recite the laws of God? And he said, no, there are hundreds of them. You know, I'd fall over. And he grasps his ankle and says, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy strength. Jesus repeats this. And, you know, again, all of the bafflement, all of the, you know, the little meanders that people will go down. He also says, speak only this one prayer, our Father that are in heaven, that art in heaven. That's your lot. That's all you get. You shouldn't be. I see these things as an outsider, and when they get into the, oh, well, you see, this is because of this and this is because of that. I'm like, no, let's go back to the essential principle.
Right.
Are we doing what we're meant to do? Are you loving God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your strength? Or are you just being horrible to me because you think, you know, some daft thing about whether Jesus had a beard or not? And of course, until the year about 300, he didn't have a beard. Jesus was clean shaven. And people who have beards, and I have warned you about this now, you go and shave it off, because two popes have said you'll go to hell for having that beard.
I'll get around to it. Get around to it. Girls seem to like it.
Yeah, well, that's much more important, let's face it. You know, heaven on earth, heaven is all around, but men do not see, as Jesus said. So this has been great, and we'll do it again at some point in the future.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure talking to you, John.
Yeah, likewise. So Anthony Spurgeon, do check out his channel and go and subscribe. He's just starting out, and it takes a while to get subscribers.
And I will say, for anyone who does subscribe, I may not, this project, you might not get weekly content, monthly content. It'll be kind of sporadic.
Ask for notifications when there's something going on.
Because
up,
I've got more fulfilling things to do, but
what
I'm
could
not
be
going
more
to stop
fulfilling?
Anytime soon. Yeah. Well, it is certainly.
You mentioned
girls.
I'm talking
about, I'm getting to that too. But yeah, I've got a lot on my plate in my life, but I know how important this is, and I've been encouraged by the response I've been getting, and I just I want to contribute in any way I can to get this message out there about these groups, because the work you guys have been doing in the anti-Scientology world, I think you guys have really boosted and bolstered the Scientology critics have been a huge amount of inspiration and for all the other groups, all the other members, because Scientology, I think, is almost the easiest target in a way in terms of the
become
broader
that
society.
It used to be a very hard target when I started doing it, and there were only about
right,
three
but
of us in the world.
Thanks to South Park, you're right. Yeah, but thanks to South Park, it's a pretty easy target.
Which
now
brings us back to the point of ridicule, doesn't it, and its value
right
in
no,
society.
No.
So
there is value in it exactly as well. The other groups that have more influence and have more power and aren't as much of a joke in my, because Scientology is kind of a joke.
And it was my determination from the early 1980s when I set out. I realized that if you painted it as sinister, that people would join it. So when in 1969, Alexander Mitchell published articles about Hubbard being involved with Crowleyite sex magic, people joined Scientology, you know. In fact, the whole swell of Scientology in 1963, Scientology was probably about 500 people. Then you had the Victorian inquiry, all of these government inquiries. And by the time the last inquiry was published, the English one in 71, there were now 25,000 people in Scientology, because it had been publicized. So I realized
Right.
that you've got to show it sinister because it is. It's life destroying. They have 4,000 slaves in Scientology. It really is a bad thing. But you also have to show that it's ridiculous so
Oh,
that
yeah.
people won't want to join it, you know. And so any 18-year-old that somebody says, "Oh, I'm just in this brilliant thing called Scientology," you go, "Tom Cruise in the closet, South Park," and there's an end to that. So, but both things are important. And
Yeah, exactly. But
what you're
yeah,
doing is
I was going to
important
say
too.
ex members of the of Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Moonies, and traditional Catholics as well. All of us have been looking at you guys and realizing the effect that this can have. And so I want to thank you for your work again. Thank
Thank you.
Chris, Shelton, everyone. I won't say, but we talked offline about this whole controversy. I'm not going to say anything about the recent unpleasantness in any detail. I'll just say that I still I just want everyone to know who's dealing with the anyone who's in the Scientology influencing world who's dealing with all this drama and all this crap. Just know that your work is still important and still valuable. I hope none of you out there I can see it wearing on people like Chris, you know, and so I
It's
just
wearing
hope
on
that
me. Yeah.
I can only imagine, you know, any flack I've been getting online have been nothing compared to all this. And so I just want you guys to know that the work that this all of you guys have done has gone far and beyond simply raising awareness about Scientology because it's put these patterns in everyone in the forefront of people's consciousness. And when you recognize a pattern, you can far more easily it gets down to the basic level of like when you're learning. It's like rock, tree. Rock look like this. Tree look like this. And so you can see, oh, cult look like this when with all the work of that you've been doing. And then you can look at other groups and just have a very basic recognition of these patterns. And so
Absolutely.
it's the Lord's work, you could say.
Bless him. Bless the Lord. Thank you so much, Anthony. We'll talk again
Thank you, John.
in the nearness of time.
Thank you, John.
And let me
Thank you very
just.
much.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much. It can be done, Anthony. Don't despair. You too can dye your food, whatever color you like.
There's hope for us all. Wow, it's so simple.